Okay, so well, let's begin with history. I'm going to mix up a little. We'll end with science, but we'll start with history. And as the beginning said, I'm going to talk about gaudy religions. That means religions with gods in them. They all fall in the same way, and I'm going to focus mostly on the Western tradition, but you might start to see how these arguments will apply to even things like Hinduism and so on. Okay, so let's start with the grand picture of history, right? Imagine religions as species of animals, and you put animals in a big family tree, essentially, right, of how they started at one original species and that radiated out into various others, into branches and leaves and whatnot. Now, think of religions in a similar way. The earliest religions date at least to 40,000 BC. Now, actually, we have evidence that goes even further back than that. But by 40,000 BC, we have shamanistic cave paintings and other things like ritual burials and things like that that indicate that there was some sort of religion going on. 40,000 years BC, think about that. Now, the first priesthoods were looking at 10,000 BC when we have cities. Or cities and villages and things, or we have actual priesthoods established. So we've got 30,000 years where humans are walking around with religions, and having religious beliefs, before they even get priesthoods. But then finally they get priesthoods, it's still 8,000 years before Yahweh comes along and says, oh, hey, by the way, I am the one true God. And you see, of course, that's just, he does this in one tiny little place. I mean, he doesn't mention the fact that he exists to anyone but one tiny tribe of goat herders in one little place. And for another 1,000 years, even after that, he neglects to ever mention this Jesus character, right? So when you look at history, this Yahweh religion, this Yahweh-based religion, even Christianity, just looks like one among many. It makes no sense from the perspective of a cosmic deity who would, of course, been revealing the gospel from, you know, year 40,000 B.C., and all cultures, all history would show that the same God was sending the same messages to people in every culture and everywhere from as far back as we have any kind of evidence of religion. Even our written records go back to about 2000 BC, and yet there's no evidence of this having occurred. So history, just in the big picture, already refutes all religions, right? If there was any God-based religion, God would consistently be talking to people with the same message, the same same belief system. But that's not what we see. What we see looks pretty much like human invention. Humans are making stuff up according to their local culture and happenstance of history. Now we skip up to look at Judaism. So we're going to start with Judaism because that's the first of the Western religions that's still around and has influenced the other major two. Now, in between 539 and 332 BC, Persia conquered Judea. Now, I want to point out, of course, that those of you who know geography, you can try to find Judea on there, the Palestine, the Holy Land, quote unquote. It barely shows up. I mean, it's basically almost just a piece of a red line of the border there. And compare that, of course, to the Persian Empire. Looks like the Persians had better gods, apparently. But the significance of that is that, now, the Persians, of course, that means Iranian. The modern-day country of Iran is the center of the Persian culture. It's where everything Persian came from. Zoroastrianism was the main Persian state religion of the time. When they conquered the Jews and hauled them off into slavery or into exile into other Persian cities, the Jews were much mixed up with and seeing the god system of this incredibly enormously powerful empire that easily conquered them. And they said, well, they can't have a better god than we do, so we better get some of these cool god attributes pretty quick. And so they borrowed a lot of the ideas that the Zoroastrians had and added them to their religion. These are attributes of Judaism that did not exist before the exile. You won't find them in the Old Testament writings that were written before the Persian conquest. But afterwards, then you start to see it happening all throughout. This idea, first of all, of a war of a good god versus an evil god, of light versus dark, that was a Zoroastrian idea. The Jews did not have that. Before the Persian conquest, Satan was actually one of the right-hand men of God and was doing the will of God. So when Satan goes down to cause evil, he was doing it on orders from God. He's not an adversary in the sense of the enemy of God. But after that, of course, Second Temple Judaism started to acquire this idea of Satan as a rebel who took a legion of angels, rebelled against God, and was cast out of heaven, and now is responsible for all evil, and now all death in the world and so forth is this big struggle between the good God and the evil God, God and Satan and so on, which the Christians picked up. But that comes from Iran. That's a Persian idea. The idea that the world will end, that was not a part of Judaism before this conquest. The idea that God's justice would be realized in one great apocalyptic cataclysm, that was a Zoroastrian belief. That came from Persia. The Jews liked that idea. They adopted it. And, of course, they turned everything around so that it would be the Persians that God would melt and not the other way around. But the idea comes from their Iranian conquerors. The idea that this world would end by a river of fire being sent by God that will flow over the universe and burn everything up except the righteous, that's Zoroastrian, the idea of the great apocalyptic burning. A new, better world that will be created in its place, the future heavenly paradise kind of thing. That comes from Zoroastrian, that Zoroastrianism. That wasn't originally a Jewish belief. And the idea then, the most crucially, that all the good people will be resurrected by God to live in that new world happily ever after. This idea of an eternal paradise life was not a part of Judaism before. When you died, you just died and stayed dead, basically. You were kind of like a vague spirit in the earth. They didn't have an idea of an eternal paradise or an eternal afterlife, but the Jews picked that up from the Zoroastrians, and it became a fundamental requirement of Judaism. Now, when you look at the Talmud, one of the requirements of being a Jew is affirming that you'll be resurrected. Everyone else is explicitly declared a heretic in the Talmud. And yet, that wasn't a Jewish belief. That was an Iranian belief picked up from the Persian cult of Zoroastrianism. So when you look at this, you realize that this is just man-made religion, right? This is not a single God who thought of all this stuff at the origin point of Judaism. There was no, you look at when God's communicating with Abraham in the Bible, he doesn't say, oh, by the way, the world is going to end at a certain time. I'm going to resurrect everybody. I'm going to burn everything. And there's this awful guy named Satan, and you need to watch out for him. That's not there, right? So not, all of that stuff gets added on later, and it's borrowed from a human-created religion of Zoroastrianism. So certainly this is a historical piece of evidence that shows that Judaism is not a God-oriented or God-originated religion. It's just another cobbled-together man-made thing. Now, other things, of course, you know there are failed prophecies in the Old Testament. But related to this idea of God, of the Zoroastrian influence on Jewish belief, I'm going to read one particular prophecy that is conspicuous for not having happened, therefore refuting the entire Bible, because they can't possibly be a supernatural deity communicating to these prophets if they get things wrong. And it's also pretty horrific here. And this shall be the plague, I'm going to read. This shall be the plague whereby Jehovah will smite all the peoples that have warred against Jerusalem. Their flesh shall rot away while they stand upon their feet, and their eyes shall rot away in their sockets, and their tongue shall rot away in their mouth. That's, by the way, where Steven Spielberg got the idea for Raiders of the Lost Ark, melting. Oh, here it is. And the same plague shall befall the horse, the mule, the camel, the ass, and all the beasts that shall be in their camps. What do the animals do? That's kind of rude. And it shall come to pass that anyone that is left of all the nations that came against Jerusalem shall go up from year to year to worship the King, Jehovah of hosts, and to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. And it shall be that whoever of all the families of the earth does not go up to Jerusalem, that's all the families of the earth, if they do not go up to Jerusalem to worship the King, Jehovah of hosts, upon them there shall be no rain. And if the family of Egypt even go not up and come not, neither shall rain be upon them. There'll be that plague too, don't forget, whereby Jehovah will smite the nations that go not up to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. This shall be the punishment of all the nations that go not up to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. Never happened. Failed prediction. But notice this idea of the apocalyptic end world, and also the idea of the Jews as the master race that the entire world will bow down to. They kept getting conquered instead by other nations like the Persians, the Greeks, and then the Romans. So consistently, history turned out exactly the opposite the way that God told them it would. And this, we see, even is connected to aspects of, oh, that's a shame. This is not coming through correctly. Well, I can't read the passage. The passage is hidden back behind there, and this isn't playing. Oh, I wonder if I can make it play. Let's see if this – no, I don't want to try it yet. So the passage that's behind there is a passage about how God's going to burn everything up, and there's a funny line in it in Malachi 4:1-3. Those who have mobile devices can look this up. And what he does – what he says there is that the Jews, the faithful of Jehovah, will be able to gamble as calves of the stall upon the ashes of the burned-up victims and the step upon the skulls of their enemies. And let's see if this happens. But this is supposed to be an animated GIF from the Terminator, which is supposed to evoke. Let's see if it works. No, it doesn't work. Okay. So unfortunately, you lose the video effect. But the joke was that I've heard this. I've seen this before. Oh, right. Yeah. So that's Judaism. And you could go on and on about that. But the point is, it's very easy to look at historical facts and show that it's a man-made religion. It doesn't have a pipeline to God. So it's not a divine thing. And so what they're saying about God is probably not true. But let's look at Christianity. Christianity is originated as a Jewish sect. And what they did is the original Christians took Judaism and they took this other fashion going on all around them and combined them to create a new version of Judaism, a sort of super Judaism. But notably, it did the exact same thing the Jews did when they were conquered by the Persians. They adopted all of these Zoroastrian ideas and made their religion different by incorporating this foreign culture that had conquered them. Well, this is exactly what the Christians then did, which is to say exactly what the Jews did again by creating Christianity, is they borrowed all of these ideas of these popular religions around them held by their conquerors, the Greeks and then the Romans, and created a new religion. And some of the gods that their new god or their revised sub-god would be based on, the Son of God, right, is all of these sons of God, except the one on the end is the daughter of God. Osiris, Adonis, Romulus, Selmoxis, and Inanna are just the ones that we know for sure had resurrection cults prior to Christianity. There are many other similar gods that could be put into this category, but they're harder to date. Inanna, on the end, by the way, we have stone tablets dating back to 1700 BC, in which she is descends to the lower world, into what we would call hell, is stripped naked, put on trial in a kangaroo court, is stricken dead by a death spell, and then nailed up, basically crucified. And then her minions come down and feed her the food of water and life 3 days later, and she's resurrected from the dead and ascends to glory. Sounds like a similar tale we've heard before, right? But it gets repeated again and again and again in all these other gods, each time transformed. All of these stories of all of these gods are completely different from each other, but have the same similar structure behind them. And the ones the Christians would most be aware of are Romulus, for example. Roman state god, his death and resurrection was celebrated in annual passion plays, actually called passion plays. They were actually acted out, the death and resurrection of Romulus, every year. It was a Roman state religion. Osiris, Egyptian god, those baptized, yes, baptized, into his death and resurrection are saved in the afterlife. Sound familiar? Zelmoxis is a Thracian, possibly Celtic god. His death and resurrection assures followers of eternal life as well. Zelmoxis was in Herodotus. Their cult is described in Herodotus, and Herodotus was one of the main school texts that would be used to teach how to write. For advanced writers who are writing at the level of the writers we see in the New Testament, who are writing in Greek, which means we can be absolutely certain that the authors of the Gospels read Herodotus, because everybody read Herodotus if you learned how to write Greek that well, and therefore they would know about Zelmoxis. It would not be a coincidence. And, of course, Egypt is right next to it. The Holy Land, quote-unquote, therefore Osiris would be well-known to them, and, of course, they were conquered by the Romans, so they would be familiar with Roman ceremonies as well. But I want to caution, some of the gods that you hear on the internet and so forth as being dying and rising gods were not, in fact. Mithras is one of the common ones that you'll hear about. He's not a dying and rising god, but he does undergo a passion. There is a passion of Mithras in which he undergoes some sort of suffering or struggle through which he acquires victory over death, which he then shares with his followers who are baptized in his name. So there is a very the similarity is still there. It's just structured differently. Incidentally, all the Gospels of Mithras were destroyed, not preserved. The only closest thing we have hints and quotations and suggestions and descriptions in various places and various texts, but no complete Gospel, and this is the only one we have. It's actually the picture Bible version. This is a comic book, essentially, of the story of Mithras from beginning to end, with the central events in the middle. But the thing is this is like having a picture Bible without having the text of the Bible. So we don't actually know what's going on in each scene because we don't have the description. But nevertheless, we can kind of make certain inferences of what was going on through it. But this is the closest we get to the Gospel of Mithras. It's a stone comic book, in a sense. But what all these gods do have in common, including Mithras and the other ones, they are all savior gods. They are all the son of God or daughter of God. Some of them are women. They all undergo a passion. Using the exact same Greek word, by the way, which means suffering or struggle in that time. They all obtained victory over death, which they share with their followers. They all do this with some form of baptism or communion or both. And they all predate Christianity. So what we're looking at here is just like the Zoroastrian scenario. This whole structural idea was borrowed and then added onto Judaism, and what you do when you take these elements and add them onto Judaism is what you get is Christianity, right? So once again, we see a man-made thing. And it wasn't a case where, like, to Abraham, God revealed in the Old Testament that there's going to be this Jesus figure and is going to, if you have faith in him, you're going to be resurrected and all of this stuff. This stuff doesn't appear until, coincidentally, when the Jews are conquered by a nation that has religions that have these elements. So it looks like man-made, not divinely made. So Christianity is just like Judaism, borrowed from other religions. Let's talk about evil. So I'm going to move on into a different period of history. It's another broad scope of history. Let's look at it that way. But we'll start with Epicurus, given this famous line. Is God willing to stop evil but unable? Then he is not powerful. Is he able but unwilling? Then he is not good. Is he both able and willing? Then how can there be evil? Is he neither able nor willing? Then why call him God? That was Epicurus, and as this meme says, atheists winning the argument since 300 BC. There's never really been a good answer to this. But we'll give one example, slavery. This photograph, I don't know if you've seen this before, it's quite famous. This was taken after the Civil War when slaves were freed in America, and this fellow wanted his wounds to be photographed and preserved for memory and disseminated so that people would see the incredible cruelty that American slavery involved. And these are Bible-thumping people, right? These are people who think the Bible is the shit. They did this to him. And this is appalling. How could any God stand by and watch this happening, much less watch it happening being done in his name with people citing his book, worshiping him, his actual worshipers, his actual followers, without saying a word? It's unbelievable. So what is the probability that a benevolent God would have a valid excuse not to say one heavenly word to his devoted believers about this ever in the whole of history, even worse in the time of American slavery? And what evidence do you have supporting that probability if you're going to make up some excuse? How likely is it, and what is it? What are you estimating? What are you basing that estimate on? Those are the questions you would ask. But in reality, from our background knowledge of benevolent beings, because we know lots of benevolent beings, they're called humans. These humans who happen to be nice people, they're among the nice humans anyway, nice humans with the power to speak unharmed, who don't have to fear anything. I mean, if you're God, you're like Superman, you're invincible, you can't have your head cut off, you can't be shot. Can't be burned. There isn't anything they can do to punish you. You can't have your job taken away, whatever it is. If you have no limitations on you that will prevent you from speaking, and you're a nice person, you have no valid excuse not to say anything. In fact, when we look at people, all the examples of other benevolent beings who are in the position of having the power to speak unharmed, a valid excuse not to speak is so rare, we never see one instance of it. And the word rare, by the way, means very infrequent, which happens to mean very improbable. And in fact, it's got to be at least millions to one against, because we know millions of benevolent people who are in this position who are vocally saying, condemning this kind of thing. If God is not doing it, then whatever excuse he has to be rarer than millions to one against. So that's one way to look at it. And of course, you know many other ways to design that argument in terms of pointing out that the excuses just don't hold up. All they do is make their theory more improbable rather than saving it. But I'm going to turn something around altogether. You've probably heard the philosophical moral argument, right? The morals only come from God. People believe there are morals, therefore God must exist, because where else would morals come from? Well, let's look at history. History actually refutes this. Let's treat atheism and theism as two different theories here. Atheism, as a theory, predicts that moral rules will only come from human beings, they will begin deeply flawed, and will be improved by experiment over thousands of years. Note, that is exactly what we observe. Slavery is just one example of many things where the moral rules were created by humans, they were deeply flawed, completely fucked up, one would say, and were improved gradually, very painfully, slowly, by experiment over thousands of years. Therefore, atheism is vindicated by the historical record. Theism, as a theory, however, predicts a universe directly governed morally right from the start. In other words, the correct moral laws are disseminated immediately from the beginning. It would have been 40,000 BC, not 800 BC. But we would also possibly see the universe actually designed to be moral. We would have justice laws, stewardship of the world, enacting justice and mercy on God through God. We see none of these things. All of the things you would expect from a moral engineer are not there. But we observe no such laws built into the universe, no stewards or law enforcers but us ever. So the theistic theory is completely refuted. Its predictions for history do not come true. It's falsified by history itself, whereas the predictions of atheism are completely verified. So the moral argument goes the other way around. So that's for morals. Now I'm going to talk about things, whether they're moral or not, but they're still involve moral concern. Yeah, what ought you do after you wipe your butt? You wash your hands, right? Okay. Everybody knows this, except Jesus, by the way. In Mark 7, Jesus comments on the Jewish tradition at the time of washing your hands and washing your utensils before you use them for meals and washing your hands before you eat. And Jesus says, this is a human tradition. It's not in the Torah. God did not command it. Therefore, you don't have to do it. You do not have to follow this rule. He says that things that go into your mouth can't harm you. Only things that come out of your mouth are evil. And meaning words, of course, but and blasphemies. But the point being is that he clearly did not know about germs, right? This is the best teaching moment in the history of the human race, where if you're a divine being, the one thing you know, if you stumbled across a TARDIS and were able to teleport, in time back to here, and people mistook you for a god and were listening to you, what was one of the first things you'd tell them about is germs, right? Because there's millions of people, kids, women, men, are dying and suffering in horrible ways because they don't know about germs. And simple things, simple hygiene, just cleaning your hands could save countless lives. And you have this guy, Jesus, who's portrayed as going around randomly healing this or that individual isolated person, but doesn't do anything like cholera, done, gone. If it was a god, you could eliminate cholera as easily as laying on hands on the earth, right? Just no more cholera, done. That would be how a god would do it. He wouldn't walk around town like a Benny Hinn clone trying to do faith healing acts. But the key thing here is that if Jesus was God or had any pipeline to God, surely he would know about germs and would teach and say, "Yo, by the way, that is a tradition of men, but it's a really good one. It'll save lots of lives. In fact, you should do this more. And you should sterilize your instruments if you're going to engage in surgery. There's all kinds of things that you should know about. And by the way, water should be potable. You should make sure it doesn't have germs in it and so on and so forth. And clean your hands after you wipe your butt." But instead, Jesus seems to act like diseases are caused by demons inhabiting a person. In other words, he acts like the same primitive mindset of the time. So here we have conclusive evidence just in the Gospels themselves. Even if you treat them as literal books, Jesus is not God, because God would know about germs. So clearly God has not been talking to anyone for all of these. This is just examples after example after example. There are many more. One could go on. So history proves God's not been talking. Islam's no different. I mean, I'll briefly just say that the Quran also fails to mention germs, incidentally. So when the angel Gabriel was rambling on and on and on with these surahs to Muhammad, you'd think by the end Muhammad would be pissed off that Gabriel didn't at any time mention germs. I mean, that would have been really helpful information. By the way, also so would the printing press and a few other things. The Quran also endorses slavery, including sex slavery, which, of course, the Old Testament also does. And therefore, the angel Gabriel thought slavery was really cool. Keep up with that. Like Judaism, God's promise of prosperity and superiority over all nations was also refuted by the opposite. I mean, almost all Islamic nations are failed states or economic disasters compared to much of the quote-unquote infidel West, which has all the power and wealth. Now, that doesn't indicate that we're morally better than them, but it does indicate that if we're going to talk about God's helping us out, it looks like our God's doing a better job than theirs. But I want to point out that all of these religions are the same religion. In fact, Christianity and Islam are just Jewish sects. They're all just different sects of the same one religion. They're all resurrection cults because they all teach basically the same thing and just differ on the details. Judaism says the world will one day be dissolved, the dead will be raised, and the loyal will become immortal. Christianity says the world will be dissolved, the dead will be raised, and the loyal become immortal. Islam says the world will be dissolved, and the dead will be raised, and the loyal become immortal. It's all the same religion. So let's just pick one and analyze it a little more closely. Now, I can't take credit for this, by the way. I'll read it in a moment, but this is a meme that went around on the internet ages ago. Someone else came up with it. They're pretty brilliant because it's spot on. This is the description of Christianity, dead honest. the belief that some cosmic Jewish zombie can make you live forever if you symbolically eat his flesh and telepathically tell him that you accept him as your master so he can remove an evil force from your soul that is present in humanity because a rib woman was convinced by a talking snake to eat from a magical tree. That is literally the Christianity that was being taught in its first, let's say, 1800 years, almost 2000 years of Christian history. Totally makes sense, right? Now, a lot of Christians say, well, okay, that sounds a little ridiculous. Okay, so I get you. That's crazy. So we can make this more sensible. And so we came up with a new and improved Christianity where all that Eve stuff, okay, rib woman, stalking snakes, okay, that's all baloney. We'll grant you that. We'll concede you that. But I still have an imaginary friend who magically manipulates the world for me, and he also magically impregnated a woman 2,000 years ago, and she bore him a son who underwent an ancient ritual of blood sacrifice in order to dispel a curse laid upon me, thus ensuring I will be immortal. Footnote, although I've never seen this work for anyone else before. Now, that's completely honest and correct analysis of Christianity, a description of it, and yet it looks absurd when you actually spell it out that way. But what if someone came up to you and said that they have an imaginary friend named Zalmoxis, who they insist is really real, and they'll never die because this ancient demigod cleansed their soul with blood magic, which grants them the power of living forever in a magical place no one can see? That actually existed. That was the description of the Zalmoxis cult, which is attested in Herodotus, as I mentioned, 500 years before Christianity. So if Zalmoxis cult is ridiculous, Christianity is ridiculous because it's just the Jewish version of the same religion. But let's go to history more recent. Heaven's Gate cult. The Heaven's Gate cult was in California, and they committed suicide, mass suicide, believing that their souls or the information in their brains would be teleported into a spaceship. They thought they'd get new bodies in this alien spaceship that was flying by the Earth at the time. This whole belief, this idea that when they die that they'll be resurrected in new superior bodies, that's the Christian belief. This is just the scientific version of Christianity. So you have them saying that they'll get new bodies in an alien spaceship flying by versus what the Christians say is that they'll get new bodies in a magical alternative universe. The weird thing is the Heaven's Gate cult makes more sense, right? Because in point of fact, they're talking about quantum teleportation and neural engineering, which are actual things that exist. We almost have the technology now. We can see how to build this technology within 50 to 100 years. We'll have it. It'll be a simple matter to simply copy a brain and rebuild it in another man-made body. All of that stuff is technology that's within human reach and within human understanding. So their idea actually made sense. There really could have been a flying saucer flying by. And if there was, and that those aliens probably could have scanned their brains and reproduced them in new superior synthetic bodies on the ship. It's entirely possible. But let's compare this to what the Christians are saying. The Christians are saying not that. They're saying that God needs blood to fix the universe, but only his own had enough magical power to do it, so he gave himself a body and then killed it. Now, when you look at it like this, Christians are talking about voodoo and magic and stuff. They're not talking about anything that even has plausibility. The Heaven's Gate cult is actually more believable than Christianity. So if the Heaven's Gate cult is absurd, Christianity is absurd. So, okay, that all looks bad. But the usual thing is, can't we fix the plot holes with elaborate explanations? And I've misspelled explanations I see here. Explanations? I was hoping there'd be a joke in there somewhere, but there really isn't. Can't we make excuses? But the thing is, if we have to make excuses, regardless of what they are, and our excuses have no evidence for them, in other words, and they don't, because that's why we're making them up, right, on the spot, and those excuses are very improbable, and they typically are, like having an excuse not to mention to your own devoted believers for thousands of years that they shouldn't be keeping slaves, if your excuses are very improbable, then your theory is very improbable. If you have to use an improbable excuse to tack that onto your theory, the improbability of that excuse then attaches to the theory, right? So the theory becomes as improbable as your excuse, or actually more improbable, because if you have multiple excuses, those improbabilities multiply, right? And those of you who know how to do basic probability math, basic multiplying of probabilities, you'll notice that this probability gets smaller, smaller, smaller exponentially. And the fact still is that God has never communicated any essential scientific knowledge, ever. No germ theory of disease is in the Quran, in the Old Testament, or the New Testament, for example, nor anything else that's significant like that. God has also never communicated any essential moral knowledge. For example, he completely dropped the ball on slavery. God has never even communicated any consistent religious knowledge of any kind, despite claims going on for 40,000 years, all these different religions, no consistency whatsoever. So these facts remain, no matter what excuses you make for them. And these three facts are exactly what you'd expect if there are no gods, but they're not at all what you expect if there are gods. Okay, so maybe we can grant that. What if God is a total douchebag then, right? Can't there be one of those? And at least then, maybe, yeah, he doesn't care about germs or slaves. Maybe, yeah, he's totally pro-slavery. He wants us to die of diseases. He's a total awful asshole. Okay, well, but he could still exist, right? So you really haven't refuted God yet. So there's really two possible kinds of douchebag gods. The one is natural beings, which are aliens, computers, and things like that. We could be living in the Matrix right now, and the douchebag gods could be our AI agents or whatever. But we're going to rule that out because that requires positing two improbable universes to explain one of them. So that leaves us with the other kind of douchebag god, which is the supernatural being, the being that has irreducibly mental powers, a sort of a brainless, bodiless ghost mind that can just will things into existence. There are two hypotheses then left. The God hypothesis, which is that the universe was designed by a ghost even to produce life. The godless hypothesis, that the universe was not designed to produce life. And the first thing you look at is when you compare these two hypotheses is that we've done this comparison before, again and again and again. The explanation of lightning, the explanation of disease. Jesus thought it was demons. It actually turned out to be germs. And on and on and on. We have constant millions and millions of examples of where supernatural explanations were proffered and they turned out to be false, and natural explanations turned out to be true instead. Now, when you have a horse that wins every single one of a million races, and you have another horse that loses every single one of a million races, and they're about to go head-to-head in another race, which horse do you bet on? It's kind of a no-brainer conclusion, right? So even from the start, before I even continue, I could fold this and walk off stage and I'd be done, right? There's no probable basis for believing in any gods, even douchebag gods. But I'm going to go on because it's funny. Now, unfortunately, my animations aren't working, so I'll talk you through this slide. This is the history of life, right? So we've got 2.4 billion years. Life began, and then there are about 2.4 billion years after that, where life was just sitting around evolving as single-celled life. Now, in actual fact, single-celled life is over six times more evolved than plants and animals just by time alone, right? Animals have only been around about 0.6 billion years, in other words, 600 million years, whereas single-celled life has been around 3.7 billion years, so about six times more. So single-celled life, bacteria, for example, have been evolving six times more and longer than we have. So they're actually way more evolved than we are. But in fact, the rate of evolution for single-celled life is actually 500,000 times faster than for multi-celled life like animals, which means that single-celled life is actually many billions of times more evolved than your hand, for example. So single-celled life is badass. Now, that makes a lot of sense in terms of evolutionary theory, but it makes no sense in terms of God. God really likes bacteria. I mean, he spent most of his time working on those suckers, but very little of his time working on us. So what was God doing for the 2.4 billion years fiddling around? And he's got all these single-celled organisms. He doesn't know what to do with them. He can't even figure out that maybe they could work together to do something. And then eventually he comes up with the idea that, you know what, maybe they could congregate together and make more complex entities like algae. Algae, that's clever. So he creates things like algaes where multiple cells can cooperate. But he's still sticking around with those for a billion years before he realizes, oh, you know what, maybe I should have these cells differentiate their function so that we can have a more complex animal. Why didn't I think about that 3.4 billion years ago? Still couldn't figure it out, but eventually did, and he comes up with this differentiation of cells within a multi-celled organism about 0.6 billion years ago. But then it takes him 500 million years to figure out apes, just apes, right? So he's tinkering around with mice and bugs and all kinds of this stuff, but no, it takes him a while to go, apes, oh, right, maybe I should do something with those. And then even when he gets to apes, it takes him 4 million years more of tinkering before he figures out how to make people. What was he doing for 4 million years? God, these apes are really stupid. Why can't I fix them? They should be smarter than this. Oh, right, maybe I should do something with the brain. I don't know. When you look at this, you realize that this is exactly what we should expect if life is a natural product of random evolution. It would obviously take billions and billions of years for us to evolve. Obviously, single-celled life would have to evolve vastly longer in order to develop the intercellular machinery and complexity to actually start engaging in cooperation. And it obviously, once you have cells engaging in cooperation, it would take a very, very long time for them to evolve the sophisticated machinery that would allow them to start differentiating tissues and therefore creating what we recognize as plants and animals. So this is exactly what we expect if there's no God. It makes no freaking sense if there is a God. Even a douchebag God would be more time efficient than this. So what does the godless hypothesis predict? This is what we would expect to see if we are alive, if we exist, and there is no God, and the universe therefore had to have come about by random chance or whatever. What would we expect to observe? What could we predict about the universe we find ourselves in? The moment we open the door and look outside, what would we see? What we would see is that almost all of the universe will be lethal to life, right? If you pick random universes, you're going to get one that, you know, if it's a universe that's completely hostile to life, obviously that you're never going to be in that universe, right? Because if you're alive, you're not in that universe. So you would never observe that universe. The probability of that being outside when you open the door is 0%. But if the universe is randomly picked from among all the possible universes that could just by chance maybe produce life, then what you're going to see outside that door, if it's not been intelligently designed, is a universe that's almost entirely lethal to life, but life is just a very small, a very rare occasional outproduct of it. Now, because we know in this case, if life is not engineered, if it's not intelligently designed, it has to be an extremely improbable chemical accident. The right chemistry has to come together just the right way. So we know that's a cat. We have to concede that. That's true. If there's no God designing things, there's no designer, that's the only way life could come about. But we also know from probability theory that extremely improbable events almost always occur only in vast spaces and timescales. In other words, if an event is a billion to one against, but you have a billion events, right? So the odds of you having one of those events is actually quite high. So what you would expect to see outside that door is a really enormous number of failed attempts to create life and just one or a few random successes, because that's what you would normally appear to see if there's no design. But that's what we notice, right? This is what we look at. When we look outside that door, what we see is a universe that trudged along for 10 billion years before life began on Earth. We see there are trillions of galaxies, with billions of stars each, and many planets and moons on average per star. And that's just the part of the universe we can see, by the way. The universe is actually predicted to be many times larger than even the part we can see. So that trillions is probably a low estimate, a very low estimate of galaxies. And we notice that single-celled life, like I pointed out, evolved for 2 billion years before multicellular life arose from it. All of these things that we expect to see if life is a product of random chance and not a product of design. We could have predicted that without even knowing it before we looked outside the door. But it gets worse than that. When you look at the universe and map and catalog what's in it, 99.99999% of the universe is a lethal radiation-filled vacuum. Think about that. That's almost the entirety of the universe. It's a tiny, tiny, tiny little bit that is not a lethal radiation-filled vacuum. So God really, really likes lethal radiation-filled vacuums if he's the designer. But it gets worse than that, because once you erase all of that and let's just focus on the stuff. Okay, there's very little stuff. It's almost all deadly space. But what's left, let's look at that. We just look at the material. 99.999999% of all the material in the universe composes stars and black holes on which nothing can live, right? Think about that. Like, most of the matter in the universe is dedicated to these gigantic things called stars and black holes that are vastly huger than planets. All that mass, and they are exactly the one place where life is not going to be found. They're incredibly lethal and hostile to life. You can't live there. And then, okay, so set aside all of that and just look at the tiny little crumbs that remain. 99.99999% of all the other material in the universe, space dust, asteroids, planets, moons, is barren of life or inhospitable to life. That's an extremely bizarre thing to observe for an intelligently designed universe that's supposed to be custom built to make life, right? This is actually the opposite of what we would expect then. But this is exactly what we'd expect to see the moment you open the door if there is no God, because the only universe we could be in is one like this. Or at least the probability is extremely high. That's what we'd see. And I want you to think about this in terms of scale. Imagine this house that I've got up here. Now imagine this house contains the entire universe that we know about, the entire known universe. The amount of volume in this house that would be hospitable to life, the rest of it is completely entirely lethal to life, the amount of volume that would be hospitable to life would be smaller than a single proton. Not smaller than a bacterium, even smaller than the proton in an atom in a bacterium. If you walked into that house, would that you see that it's almost entirely lethal to life, and you couldn't even find the one proton that life was living on in there, would you conclude that the house was designed to create life or designed to be hospitable to life? No, you'd conclude the opposite. Now, it's worth pointing out that Aristotle actually thought the universe was much more conducive to life than this, and he described it a complete cosmos. In going all the way to the stars, it was completely inhabited and completely inhabitable. Aristotle's universe was 10 to the power of 30 times more hospitable to life than ours is, which means Aristotle is a vastly better engineer of universes than God would be, apparently. Maybe, I think even a douchebag God could outdo Aristotle, but evidently not. So the results. We cannot predict any distinct features of this universe on the God hypothesis. Almost all the distinct features of it are unexpected. To the contrary, the God hypothesis predicts very different observations should be made. But we can successfully predict numerous very weird features of this universe, its vast size and its incredible lethality and all of that, on the godless hypothesis. In fact, the probability that the universe would look like this, the way I've described it, is 100% expected. It's exactly the universe we should expect to see the moment we look out the door. Now, so then what they'll come up with is, well, but fine-tuning is so improbable, and the universe requires fine-tuning. The problem is that their God requires more fine-tuning. In fact, they're proposing, first of all, they're proposing something we have no evidence of, a brainless mind, a mind without a body. We have no evidence that that's even a possible thing. So they're already off the rails from the start. But even if we grant them that, what they're proposing is that there is a mind that just happens to exist for no reason that is at least as complex as a human mind, because he has to be at least as intelligent as a human and at least have at least as much knowledge as a human. In reality, of course, their God they're imagining is vastly greater than that and therefore vastly more complex. But if you're going to pick random soulless or random bodiless minds out of a grab bag of all logically possible bodiless minds, and you want to get something that's human intelligent or better, you're going to have to get information specificity equivalent to human or better. And in fact, information specificity, the complexity of human intelligence, is in the vicinity of 10 to the power of 5 billion. So think about that, 10 to the power of 5 billion. That's extraordinarily unlikely. In other words, the attributes required for a creator are extraordinarily improbable attributes to have. Theology thus posits an even greater coincidence than a random universe. They want to explain a mildly finely tuned universe by positing a massively finely tuned God and not explaining where that fine tuning came from. And maybe they'll go to gods all the way down, like the turtle argument, but I think that's a losing way to go, and you know they won't go there. So here's the summary. No moral God is likely to exist on present evidence, quite clearly. Only very improbable excuses can rescue God from that. No supernatural causes or communications have ever been discovered, but millions of natural ones have. Excuses make no difference to the resulting probability. And the universe is contrary to predictions of any likely God hypothesis. Only improbable excuses make it fit. And the universe is exactly what is predicted by the godless hypothesis. Even really weird predictions come true. And that's the state of things, and that's where we get from science and history. So we could write Ulan Khalufa's book long before he actually is supposed to have written it, according to Douglas Adams. And I could say, well, that about wraps it up for God. Thank you.
We're going to open up the floor to questions, and I'm going to exercise my right as a host to ask the first one. And what I'd like to ask is that,
sorry,
I understand what you're saying about Christianity and other religions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What would your position on the existence of God be? As opposed to separating religion from God.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. And I expect that I know what the answer is.
Well, yes, of course. That was
like, put it out there.
The second half of my talk was about douchebag gods. Those are all the gods that no one would worship because he's so awful and doesn't care about anything. So that's the second half of that, showing that even those gods, even gods outside of religion, even gods that don't care what you believe in or any of that, we have no evidence or reason to believe those gods. Instead, the universe looks exactly like it should look if there is no God, and therefore we should go where the evidence leads on that.
Right. Okay. Excellent. So for questions, just put your hand up there. I'll come rushing out there and put the microphone in your face, and you can ask your questions away.
Good.
And so let's have a show of hands. Who wants to ask a question?
I can't see you, so he'll find you.
Yeah. Oh, here we got a question right back here. Do you want to state your name and give us your question?
Name is Greg, and the question is this: Zoroastrianism that you begin speaking about and how everything else is borrowed from that. I suspect most of the audience here agrees with you that that's mostly made up nonsense that goes back 40,000 years. I know you're not a psychologist, but how do you make sense of so many believers ignoring all of the evidence you presented here today?
Oh, yeah. Well,
and coming to a conclusion that it's reasonable to believe.
Yeah,
that
this brings up a topic that came up at the brunch earlier today. There's an entry at Wikipedia. Go to Wikipedia and type in list of cognitive biases, and a massive, massive list. And a lot of them have dedicated pages that you can link through to read about. The human brain, I'm just going to put it bluntly, is totally fucked up. It has not evolved very intelligently. It makes a lot of cognitive mistakes very easily. And in fact, you have to develop very sophisticated cultural technology as a giant software patch to fix it, and that software patch often doesn't work, and not everyone is installing it. And that's what science and reason and logic and mathematics are. I'll just give you one example. Now, mind you, the list of cognitive biases, and all of them can have a tendency to enhance or maintain ridiculous beliefs, but I'll pick one that's particularly talked about by a lot of scholars of religion, which is agency over detection. The idea is, and I mean this has been tested scientifically, but the idea is that we evolved to be agency detectors. It's valuable for us to know when there's a particular agency that's chasing after us, or you know, is an intelligence that we have to thwart or appease or work with. So, for example, if you're walking in the woods and you hear rustling in the grass, and you assume, or you just assume that it's the wind, but it's really a predator, you die. You get subtracted from the gene pool. But if you're walking through the forest and you hear rustling and you assume that it's a predator but it's really just the wind, the cost is very low. You survive, but you know the time and energy, very little cost to that. So that in fact we have evolved a tendency to over-detect agency, and that's why we human religions all throughout cultures and history, in the earliest times of history, were animistic. Everything had souls. Trees had minds, and the wind had a mind. And you could have a stick that had a mind. This was this kind of idea of agency over detection. It was very easily done. As we evolved civilizations and city-states, then the idea of these animistic spirits became congregated into, or you know, taking a bunch of different gods and just saying, oh, it's all just one god. So you have, you know, the wind god or the city god and so forth, so that you had what we call polytheism. Now, as political structures became more monocratic, where you have you start to have empires, single individuals ruling over empires, you get monotheistic religions. Zoroastrianism is bitheistic in the sense it has two gods, but it really has only one god you're supposed to worship, so it's monolatric. So it is really the original monotheistic cult. And Egypt tried to experiment with this as well. Rome did a little bit later. But even when you subordinate the other gods, you have the one supreme god under them or above them. And then the next step is to have them all be agents of his, so they become angels and saints and stuff like that. They still have godlike powers, and they're still basically gods, but we just conveniently don't call them that. So you can look at it politically. What people have done is just kept their animistic tendencies, but they've just aggregated all the animism and thrown it onto one single mind now. So when people say they believe in God, they're still saying they believe in tree spirits and sky spirits and wind spirits. It's all the same spirit to them. And they literally do that. Like you have Pat Robertson saying that gay people caused God to send us hurricanes in the United States. That's just animistic wind godism. So that's just one example. There are many other cognitive biases that contribute to this, but that's my answer to that question.
Excellent answer. Do we have any more questions? Yep. There's a couple questions out there. Excellent. Hi.
So given that our origins have animistic kind of a animistic heritage, and the software bug that we kind of all bugs that we've all inherited in our brains through evolution, how do you explain then that some people refuse to kind of fall into that, like us sitting in this room? How is it that we don't have and shape those same beliefs, even though we were raised and immersed in this from the same influences as somebody who is deeply religious?
Yeah. This is actually an important psychological question. It's only recently, like within the last 10 years, that scientists have started asking that question and building research tools to answer it. Phil Zuckerman, I think it was Zuckerman, created the Institute for Secular Studies at the Claremont University, where their whole mission there is to actually answer questions like that by starting to study how do skeptics differ from believers? Is it cultural? Is it psychological? And was it biological? And so there are roots to all of these things. Some people have different tendencies. You know, some people are born with cognitive biases that are stronger than other people due to random genetic variation. That's part of it. We know, for example, from twin studies that biology explains about 50% of your religious belief. So there is a strong biological component. But the other component is cultural, and that depends on how you've been raised. It depends on what information you've been exposed to. It depends on your education and so on. A lot of the people here, for example, are probably highly curious people, that there may be a genetic component to your curiosity. Once you start getting curious, and that means you're going to start asking questions, and you're going to start gaining information and learning things that other people don't. People who are less curious aren't going to fall down that path and aren't going to accumulate that knowledge, for example. And that's just one single change that you can make in someone that can make a difference in terms of where they end up in terms of religious belief. And when they do things like twin studies, they can look at, for example, how when the twins don't have the same religious belief, they can look at, well, then what were the differences in terms of environment? Because then it's not genetic, it's something environmental. And then it's just a question of what parents did they have? How were they abused or treated as children? There's a lot of different aspects of this in terms of psychology. Religion has culturally built itself to be self-perpetuating in many ways. I was just a couple days ago, just last night, watching Jesus Camp, right? So this is an extreme example, but nevertheless an example of how you can so fuck up someone's brain that they'll be stuck in religion and they'll be extremely immune to the software patches that you need to install to get them out of that. And that's just a cultural thing that's just forcing that on them and is distorting their brains and doing them real actual psychological harm as a result. That's just one example of many different influences like that. So the answer to that question is multivariate, and it's still something that we're studying in terms of what we can actually do to answer that question. But it's going to come down to probably a lot of different causes like that. Okay, we have another question.
Yeah, excellent. We've got a question over here, and then I'll come over and ask your question over there.
So my question is, do you think that with all the software patches and things that we would need to do with people, is possibly convincing historians in general and scholarly work that gods are made up and that the Bible is made up and some of your other work, is that a good way to deconvert people, or is that possibly going to go against what a lot of people would be willing to accept?
Well, I know already for a fact. I mean, I've traveled the country, traveled North America, Canada, and the U.S. for about 10 years now, and I've been in many rooms with anywhere from 50 to hundreds of people at a time. And many, many times I've asked the question, you know, how many of you are hardcore believers? Now you're not a believer. Lots of hands come up. And then you ask them, like, was it people like me communicating things that, you know, doing what you're talking about, disseminating the truth and counteracting lies and misinformation and things, was that responsible, at least in part, for their deconversion? And the hands stay up largely. So we know that happens. And I've had many people tell me their personal stories, like how my writing an article against God, you know, saying that God is ridiculous and this is why, really made them think and convinced them that, you know what, you're right, this is ridiculous, and they got out of it. So we know that works. Now, the way it works is, in general, is if you do that kind of thing, you do information dissemination, you do debunking and all of that, you will get a certain percentage of the population to wake up. But then you have the remaining percentage that might be immune to that particular process, and then there might be some other process that will work on them. And there's a variety of different things you could think of in terms of how you might get them out of religion. Some of them is just letting them die off and just trying to make sure their kids don't get brainwashed or abused into believing the same thing. But each particular technique might you know, siphon off a percentage until you get down to people who are just full-on actually clinically insane, and there really is no treatment for them other than actual traditional medical treatments, clinical treatments. And that you'd get maybe like a 5 or 10% of the population where they're schizophrenic or something like that. So I think that's the answer to your question, is yes, it works. It works on a significant percentage, so it's going to get us numbers. But then that doesn't – you still have the other percentage that are going to be immune to that, and you have to figure out strategies for how you're going to marginalize them or get them to start seeing reason and start acting rational, think and having information and thinking correctly. I mean that – so you have to come up with other strategies. And there are a variety of people who are coming up with those strategies and proposing them.
Excellent. Thanks very much, Richard. Got another question right over here.
Do you think the argument that was originally proposed by Sigmund Freud, that the reason why people subscribe to such irrational beliefs is because they fear their own death, is the main contributing factor to people continuously clinging to those irrational beliefs?
I'm not sure. It's unlikely, because I know lots of hardcore believers that for them the belief in the afterlife was a source of great anxiety for them because they were constantly afraid of that they would go to hell. And that they actually felt much better once they realized, oh, death, I just died, I ceased to exist, that's so much better. So I've talked to a lot of ex-evangelicals who've told me that, for example. So it isn't always that. But I do know people who say that that was like the last thing that kept them in. So I would say that there lots of people stick to religion for a lot of different reasons. And sometimes they stick to religion for a number of reasons simultaneously, and you knock them off one by one until they all fall, right? So for some people, that would be the case. For some people, that's not the case. And in terms of percentages, you'd have to do a more concentrated psychological study to find out, like, for how many people is that the case? So we don't really know, but it is more complex than just that.
Excellent. Thanks very much, Richard. Got another question right here. If you still got time to ask some more questions?
What time are we at? So
quarter to four right now.
Okay, and how long did we want to go? I mean –
You want to go to 4 o'clock? Is that too long?
Sure. No, not at all.
Yeah. Okay, let's shoot for 4 o'clock.
Okay.
All right.
Okay. A while ago, I read In the Shadow of the Sword, which is about the origins of Islam, and a good deal of it sounds like the sort of analysis you did of Judaism and Christianity taking stuff from the already
mm-hmm.
existing religions.
Mm-hmm.
Have you read that?
No, I haven't. No. And I'm not an Islamic studies expert either, so there's very little I can comment on usually on that.
All right. Do we have any more questions? Oh, there's a couple back here. Let's go back here. Hang on.
Hello. Good afternoon.
Hi.
The God Helmet. Have you heard or read anything about it?
Oh, you mean the device that makes you experience God?
Yes.
Is that what you're referring to? I haven't kept up the reading on that. I think that got challenged. I think there's been a challenge in the literature to whether the original study was fully kosher or not. So I don't know if that actually holds up. Pun not intended, but I will claim it after the fact is intended. So I'm not really sure how that holds up in terms of the research, but in principle, we do know that there are centers of the brain that if you activate them in a certain way, that you'll have certain experiences that are bizarre. Certain experiences that can make you feel like there's someone, a presence near you, for example. Because we know that there's the parts of our brain that's what their job is, right, is to figure out that there's someone behind us and we need to turn around or that we're in the presence of someone. And so all you have to do, you can literally stick a physical wire into the brain and stimulate that thing. You don't need the electromagnetic helmet necessarily. And do that. So there's lots of things like out-of-body experiences that you can do. You can do the powerful feeling of being loved. Because we know our brain already has the architecture for a powerful feeling of being loved, because otherwise we would never be able to feel that. So if you can actually stimulate that and then make people think that it's being stimulated by something like, oh, God is near you, rather than, oh, there's a wire stuck in the right part of your brain, then, yeah, obviously you can manipulate the brain to actually have Godist experiences. When I was – I actually was never a fundamentalist. I was never really a Christian in any real sense. My only – a fanatical religion, I would say, the only thing that I truly believed in was Taoism for several years of my life. And it was because I was convinced by powerful religious experiences that convinced me that the Taoism was the one true religion and the Tao was something that actually existed and you could actually conform your life to it and it would actually make your life better if you did. And the most powerful of these experiences I had was an altered state of consciousness. And I did this through meditation originally, but I got to the point where I no longer needed to meditate to put myself in these states. And so I got to that point where I could do it at any time. And there was one occasion, and I'm going to give you the backstory so a lot of you who know science will immediately know what was really going on. I found that out later. But so I was a flight deck firefighter in the United States Coast Guard long ago. And so I was on and due to the nature of life at sea in the military, you often have overlapping duty schedules that prevent you from sleeping. So I was awake for about 36 hours just working on various projects on the ship simply because of these duty schedules. Now, occasionally I'd get like a half an hour nap here and there in that period, but never really any sleep. So this is massive sleep deprivation. So 36 hours, and this was common, by the way. It wasn't unusual. And at this time, we were just happened to be at sea. We just happened to have a search and rescue mission where the helicopter was just sent away so that everybody could return to the regular stations. And I was there. One of the things I was doing was there holding a fire extinguisher for a particular operation going on. But that was all done, and so I could put the fire extinguisher away or whatever, and everybody was packing up and leaving the air section of the ship. But at that point, we were at sea in international waters, hundreds of miles from land, and we were under – it was a perfectly clear sky. So we were underneath one of the most amazing star fields you'll ever see. And I immediately had one of these powerful mystical experiences where my mind expanded to encompass the entire universe so that I was actually merging with all these stars in the universe. And I experienced the actual visual literally like vertical visual sense and understanding that there were a lot of these little green points throughout this universe that had living civilizations on them. And all of this was in harmony with the Tao. And it was this whole like powerful, moving experience of feeling so at harmony with this idea, and it was so right, and it was all just the perfection of the Tao. It really made sense of everything. So that was an example of a really powerful altered state of consciousness I had, which just gives you the point that you can have these altered states of consciousness that aren't even focused on any particular God. They might be focused on something that's sort of a vegetable mind-like being, like the Tao, for instance. And so obviously what that was a sleep deprivation hallucination, right? And when I started to realize that, and I kept studying science in conjunction with realizing that there were flaws in the philosophy, because I was studying Confucianism as well, and Taoism and Confucianism are arguments against each other, and sometimes the Confucians are right and sometimes the Taoists are right, I started to realize this is all man-made and that I was just fooling myself through motivated belief into making these altered states of consciousness, these hallucinations, match what I expected to be the case. So my brain was just generating them, and it was generating them in exactly the way I expected them to generate, and therefore it was verification bias in the most spectacular sense. So even if there was a machine that could do that, that's all it's really doing is something like that.
Excellent. Got another question for you here, Richard.
Hi. So in the description of a God who could have told mankind about germs earlier,
yeah,
like a benevolent God,
mm-hmm.
So I think I'm correct in saying it was Louis Pasteur.
Pasteur.
Great, my French isn't that good. So it wasn't until the late 19th century. So is it possible, like when you did your study of Christianity in the Old Testament, they had these rules. You made a reference of Mark chapter 1.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be New Testament. But Old Testament, there's these rules like cleanliness,
yeah,
laws. So there's mankind being given rules to govern the way they gather in community to protect against something that they don't fully understand yet until,
yeah,
the late 19th century.
Yeah, the only problem is that those rules aren't in the Bible, right? That was all Jesus' point, was that they aren't in the Bible. They were invented later by Jewish communities later. Probably under influence from, for example, the Roman civilization, which had a much better concept of hygiene than the Jews originally had. So these ideas were not in the Bible. They were not communicated by God in that way. And so they were man-made. That was Jesus' whole argument, right? But in addition to that, the rituals that they were talking about are completely insufficient, right? So there's lots of different things you should be doing if you understand the germ theory of disease. Just washing your hands is not really sufficient. It's better than not doing it, right? But it would be even better to do it with soap, for example. No one ever thought of soap until the Germans invented soap, and then the Romans thought that was a cool idea and then borrowed it from them. But this actually, the introduction of soap into civilizations post-dates Christianity. So even the idea of soap didn't exist. The idea of sterilizing medical instruments, the idea of maintaining potable water, actually getting diseases out of water, for example, didn't occur to them, wasn't communicated to them. So what we're seeing here is just man-made struggling, floundering around with different ideas, not really understanding what's going on. Whereas a person who actually went back there and understood this stuff could explain to them in specific detail exactly what germs are and how to kill them and how to avoid them. And then you would see more pervasive behaviors of avoiding them like we see today. Now, of course, that's just communication. That's just if you're just all you can do is talk. God could, of course, simply disintegrate all the germs. So there really isn't even reason for there to be germs if there's a benevolent God. So even just the existence of germs isn't a refutation of the existence of a benevolent God. But then you have the douchebag God, but then maybe the douchebag God wants you to die from germs and therefore won't tell you about them. So.
Excellent, Richard. Actually, this gentleman kind of wants to rebut just a little bit on that.
Sure, go for it. Yeah.
This will probably just open up the conversation and make it a little bit more interesting even.
Sure. So you're saying that in Jesus' reference to how you should live cleanly was a New Testament reference. So you're talking about Roman time period, but Levitical law and Numbers, that's where the reference of how you should take care of your clothes if it gets some uncleanliness in it, or don't touch animals. So we're talking about something that predates your Roman reference.
Yeah, but those are actually ritual cleanliness rules. So there are things like you shouldn't touch a woman for many days after she has her period, which is massively ignorant, right? It has nothing whatsoever to do with avoiding germs or disease. Women don't become diseased when they start having their period. They had the idea that even just touching a tomb would communicate disease, which is not true at all. Touching a tombstone is not going to give you a disease. So these are ideas of their notion of what was ritual impurity was leading them to do this. And these are primitive, non-scientific, and pseudoscientific ideas.
All right. Excellent, Richard. I'm just going to give this gentleman one chance to just kind of make his last statement, then I'm going to move on to other questions. All right?
Oh, sure.
Well, you look like you wanted to say it.
Well, I already figured that I was given the timeout.
So. Okay. Oh, not from me,
okay.
No.
All right, excellent. Okay, do I have any more questions out there? Yeah, all right, okay. Hang on for a second, Helen.
Hi, Richard, thank you. My concern is children. And with regard to your quotation, religion has built in ways to be self-perpetuating. What would be your best intervention to help children? There's so many homeschools, charter schools, private schools. What, have you got any suggestions on how we can get rid of the adults and help the children?
Excellent question.
Yeah. I mean, most fundamentally, what we need to do is make sure that critical thinking skills are taught in schools. Now, there's a problem with this. At least I can speak to the American experience. Every time people tried to get critical thinking taught in schools, conservatives would get a hold of it, fuck it up, and then it wouldn't work. And then they'd see, it doesn't work. So let's stop talking about teaching critical thinking skills in school. This is what, of course, the Republicans do in our country all the time, is they have a really great bill, they fuck it up, then it doesn't work, and then they see, these things don't work, so let's not even talk about them anymore. They deliberately sabotage these things. So it's really hard to do. But when I talk about critical thinking, I mean the kind of stuff that is taught, for example, at the Center for Applied Rationality, CFAR. You can look this up online. The Center for Applied Rationality, is what they do is they teach courses predominantly, for example, for business people, because businesses, corporations want to make good decisions, so they send their people to this company to learn how to make good decisions, right? These are the kinds of things that we should be teaching our kids, exactly what they're doing there. And what they teach them is they teach them all that stuff. I said that list of cognitive biases earlier. They actually teach all of that stuff to these people and say, these are all the ways your brain is built to fail, and these are all the steps you can take to counteract those things. So it's like one big, perfectly designed software patch system. And they also teach things like Bayesian reasoning. They teach logic. They teach you how to reason and how to question and how to test claims. And that's a lot of what they do, and how to compare different possible claims. And they teach a lot of different things that if you knew them, you would be very much inoculated against any kind of religion. And it wouldn't be 100% effective, but it would be very effective in terms of percentage of people that would be affected by it. So that's the kind of thing that we should be teaching in high schools, for example, or even maybe as much as we can in earlier grades. And I think when you get that, and because you see it naturally, you see people often talk about how the internet is ending religion in the sense that internet is the biggest enemy of religion because religion can't lie anymore, right? if some parent tells their kids something like, if you have sex, you're going to get a sexually transmitted disease or you're going to get pregnant or something like that, and they know tons of kids that are having sex and have neither things happen to them, they know their parents are lying, right? But even with the internet, if they make some religious claim, they can immediately Google it and they can see that there's a lot of people questioning that claim or the facts don't line up with it. And once they are willing to realize that their parents just lied to them, not only are they on the track for getting away from religion, but now they know that their parents are liars, right? So now their parents have actually discredited their own authority, so they actually lose their ability to influence a child in terms of convincing them of things, because now they know to be suspicious of everything they say and to double check it. And there are a lot of kids that get to that point on their own, right? Critical thinking skills would get as many kids as possible already doing that. Like, I'm going to fact check what you just told me, and what you just told me is not true. So the more kids that actually act that way and have that attitude and are trained to do it well, the less religion we're going to see in the world.
Excellent, Richard. Excellent. Let's do one more question, and then let's move on to the book signing.
Very good.
Okay. I'm kind of frustrated, I guess, as a layman, because it's really hard to research ancient history.
Mm-hmm.
I know you must have put in many, many years and a lot of hours, and I know that you did a lot of research looking into the historicity of Jesus.
Yeah.
So I'm just curious, what does that research look like? Like, what is it that you actually do? Do you read old books and ancient languages? And, like, what is it?
I do. I actually teach a whole course on this. I teach online courses for a group called the Partners for Secular Activism, and I teach this online course once a month. It's $59 to take each course. There are many other instructors teaching many other subjects. And I teach one course a month, a different thing, and every year I recycle the main ones. And one of them is the historical methodology for lay people, right? So it's like teaching people, like, this is what historians do, and this is what you can do, even if you're not a historian, to fact-check historical claims. So if you're really interested in that, you can take that course. The brief summary to answer your question is we look at all the information that's available. A lot of that involves looking at what past scholars have looked at and looking at what they've written about it. And I have to do that in multiple languages. So a lot of the stuff I rely on is not just English scholarship, but scholarship in French and in German. So I have to be able to read French and German articles. I can peck my way through Spanish and Italian articles, for example. So that's part of it. And then the other part is you have to look at the earliest sources we have, which is the ancient materials that have survived, ancient texts. And that's complicated because you could, and I have done on occasion, actually go look at a manuscript, like an ancient papyrus or a medieval manuscript or something. But most of that work's already been done for us, where someone has looked at all the different versions of a text and then compiled a critical edition that we can go look at, and they'll have, like, the ancient Greek written there, and then it'll have on the bottom all the variant readings, because all the manuscripts disagree, right? So they'll have all the variant readings, and so you know, like, what variations there are and so on. So you have to go through all of that, read the original language in Latin or Greek, and see what it originally said, and then look at context and find information that way, and then try to tie connections together through all of that. And then for the book on the historicity of Jesus, I also looked into anthropology and psychology, because there's psychology of ancient religions, psychology of modern religions, but it applies to ancient religions, and anthropology of religion and so on. So I had to study all of this stuff and tie it all together, and then present a case based on that. And it's hard work. It takes a lot of time and a lot of training to be able to do that, which is what the PhD is for. It teaches you to know how to do all of this stuff. And I see my role in the atheist community is doing that so you don't have to. So that's kind of my role, is to get all that, do all that work, and then disseminate all the findings as clearly and as honestly as possible to all of you so that you can make use of it. And by citing all of my sources for all of my information, you can make even more use of it. You don't have to just trust me as an authority on stuff. So that's kind of like what I do, and I'm happy to be doing that for you.
Excellent, excellent. Fascinating work, Richard. Let's give Richard a round of applause. Thank you very much.